is March 7th, 2008. I'm continuing my discussion with Hank Loeffler. We've had a long interruption here, but we're resuming and hope both of our memories are good enough to continue. The last time we were looking forward to a discussion about how funds within the Chancellor's office would be apportioned, that is gift and other funds that came in, apportioned to units throughout the campus. And so you were suggesting that this would be an interesting topic because of the kinds of diverse needs that were coming to you on a regular basis.
I guess the subject would be also the focal point of an interview with John Torfey, because he was at the absolute epicenter of the redistribution of resources on the campus, and as the Vice Chancellor for Administration, now sometimes called the Vice Chancellor Financial, John Torfey was the one who kept the book on various university budgets and how they were being allocated, and he was the one who would go and sit down with the university committee when the university committee said, help us understand the university budget, which is a little bit like saying, can you describe the shape of northern Wisconsin? It's a pretty complicated question, but on the other hand, it can also be simplified, and John would simplify it in such a way that some of the interesting budget questions might not necessarily occur to the members of the university committee because there were some other things that he had them focusing on instead. Not that he was obscuring or telling stories, he just wasn't necessarily giving them a full picture. But in part what happens in the Chancellor's office, or happened then, and I'm sure it's not happening now because the fiscal picture of the state and the university have changed. So it's hard to go back 10 years ago and try to remember what it would have been like in 1998, for example, or 1996, when the university had secured additional state funding, $29.6 million for the Madison Initiative, and we were starting what you would now call new programs with cluster hires for faculty members, which had actually started a bit before that. And there was the opportunity to apply one-time funding at various points during the year to start new programs, to do seed grant programs. While David Ward was chancellor, he actually had a contribution from John Morgridge of $1 million a year to use as seed money for new programs that he was starting, something we came to call the Chancellor's Opportunity Fund. So that if somebody came in and said, well, maybe we should have a higher education center that would study ourselves, the university, well, that fund could be used as seed money to start that kind of a program. In any event, as we were getting near the end of a fiscal year, there was a lot of planning going on, and John Torfey was the person who initiated the discussions and got everybody thinking about it. And the question was, what were the balances in various accounts? As you got near the end of the year, you would begin to discover, for example, that the university's estimates of how much money would be freed up by the receipt of federal grants might be off. You conservatively estimated how much state funding might be available at the end of the year, or how much freed up money might be available at the end of the year from the productivity of the faculty. And it would come in at some figure other than the one that you had projected, which meant that there were year-end revenues to be spent that might be originally state-funded money for a faculty member, and then the faculty member got the grant, and so you had that money left over. So that's one kind of end of the year money, and there were various dates by which you had to commit that money or spend that money.
This was one time only money, though, right?
It was one time only because you couldn't necessarily guarantee that the same number of faculty were going to be on grants in the following year. a couple of colleges famously overestimated the amount of faculty that they would have on grants, and both Letters and Science and Cal's had to pay back for their wild estimations of how many people were, because they exhausted their state budget line, and the campus had to, in effect, loan the money. So those are the kinds of estimates that you're making centrally on the campus, and certainly deciding how one-time money is going to be spent is a principal job of the Bascom administration, because they really have they're in the position to know what is prudent and what the options are.
Is this on the basis of any overall strategic plan where you have to maintain certain balances and you want to at one time give to worthy projects, but at the same time understand that you have a complex organism here that has to be supported in many different areas?
Well, a master plan is perhaps too strong, but what you would, because I don't think the state of Wisconsin would be delighted to learn that we had a master plan for spending unspent money.
Right.
They would just take it back. So this is not the sort of thing that goes to the faculty senator, to the academic staff assembly to decide or to participate in. It really is a question of what are you going to do and where are the needs the greatest. And that was what the discussions focused on. And while there was state money involved or one-time money involved, there were also funds that might be made available from the foundation or Wharf or elsewhere, Hilldale money at the end of a year, or the money coming in all along. I mean, we used to get quarterly checks for the proceeds from the Hilldale Shopping Center connection. So those kinds of revenues come in, and sometimes there are boards of directors of some of these enterprises that where the money is going to the university, but the boards themselves have to be persuaded to make an investment. Wharf is a classic example of that, where you couldn't just call up Wharf and say, send over $50 million. You would have to get their participation in things like BioStar or HealthStar, where you were committing to new building projects and you were parceling it out such that private gifts, campus contribution from Wharf, from the federal government, you were putting together a package from the state of Wisconsin, would they pay half, and you're putting all of that together. Well, those are the kinds of, at the building end anyway, those are the kinds of discussions that go on. How much can we reasonably expect that the university can invest? Because once you've made a deal with people to spend the money in a certain way, then you have to follow through on that commitment. The state of Wisconsin, of course, did not follow through on its commitment to the Wisconsin Initiative. Because they simply stopped sending the money that they were going to send on the Madison Initiative money. So that just stopped. The deal was off.
Okay. So that dissolved, more or less? Is there any remnant of it left?
Well, the state was obligated to continue supplying the amount of money that they had agreed to supply to get the match from the UW Foundation. And as soon as they stopped doing that by cutting our budget, then that deal was off.
Okay.
But there are also these other revenues that would be coming in that were either earned income revenues, they might be research park rents, they might be, there's a whole variety of different ways in which funds are generated that come from non-state sources. And the whole question was, how do you spend those? The discussion, for example, might focus on, we've unexpectedly had an increase in enrollment. The freshman class is bigger than we thought it's going to be. We need to buy courses. We need to send LNS $500,000 to offer additional sections of the courses that the freshmen will have to take in order that their progress toward diplomas isn't impeded by the fact that we have more of them than we thought we were going to have. Or there may be some other one-time projects or startup projects that might be funded. Generally, there might be additional federal 150 money coming in that would have to be spent, and how do you spend that? And slowly but surely, the campus began to use federal 150 money more and more to support staff, It used to be buying equipment and fitting out laboratories, and eventually as state money continued to decline, 150 money now pays, for example, for institutional review boards who are, the staff of those, which used to be a college function or now a federally funded function. Parts of the library, parts of the parts of physical plant, those funds began to cross the boundary and go away and quietly replace state dollars, because if we didn't have these, that's why the Madison campus is in a different position from Platteville. We have other revenues that can be shifted over. So as the state, in effect, ends its covenant with the people of Wisconsin to have a great university here, we're keeping it great by the substitution of other funds. And the annual decisions on how those funds are committed and how long they are committed was the subject of a meeting where people literally sat around with lists of possible expenditures and talk through where some of this money anyway needed to go. And generally, I would characterize the shifting of money at the end of the year and the committing of resources as going from have colleges to have not colleges, letters in science, education, nursing, other colleges that had a greater dependence on state money.
This would be the end of the fiscal year?
Or one-time new money that would be permanent. In other words, you could go to some schools and colleges during the course of the year would go to the provost and say, can you give us $300,000 to start a new initiative in the Madison Public Schools or something like that? And the answer would be, yes, we can do that for 5 years and then it's yours to pick up or something like that. So people would, it wasn't just that people were sitting around dreaming up ways of spending the money, it was that continually throughout the year, there was a recognition that some schools and colleges were having a tougher time getting by than others. And even in the late 90s, generally the money shifted away from laboratories and biosciences and things like that. And at least with the money that I'm talking about, this is where initiatives in the arts, humanities, and liberal arts would be made. In other words, if there are some projects that the Dean of Letters and Science needs to get funded, this might be a time when additional revenues outside of the budget process, outside of the public budget process, might be possible to address. There's a way to think about this. It might be $25 million in a year. It might be some significant sum of money that was available at that time for this purpose. What's happening now is it's much harder to tap that money because there isn't so much of it. Just because all schools and colleges are suffering from the loss of the state commitment. And also I'm not there anymore and I'm not privy to this kind of information.
What about outside sources? They too have diminished, I would presume, or they're not as numerous as they were before.
Well, actually, there's been a maturing of some of the investments that the university has made, because the Wharf commitment to the Institute for Discovery, for example, where they put in $50 million. I mean, we're still seeing some of the long-term arms of the university, but long-term groups having a relationship with us. You're also seeing, for example, when the School of Business can raise a quick $85 million or whatever this sum was by not naming their building, and every, so 15 wealthy alums got together and talked to one another and decided that they would give the Dean of Business this huge sum of money so that it doesn't become the Art Hovey School of Business, and which is a fine name.
That's a shame, because I was just about to pull out my checkbook.
So and I think there has definitely been a maturing in foundation development work, where if you look at the percentage of the university's budget now, or expenditures, I guess would be better, look at the university's expenditure, that the amount that schools and colleges and the campus as a whole spends every year from gifts and grants, which are foundation grants plus the Foundation earnings is now much greater than the state investment in the institution. And that, of course, wasn't the case 20 years ago. And in fact, John Wiley has a chart that shows when the intersection of when the intersection of gift money and state money occurred, and he shows 50 years from now there'll be no state money and it'll be all earned income and gift money, and it'll be a different place. So if you think of this as transitioning away from sort of reliably budgeted state funds that were coming into the institution and being spent in a very public way, now you're seeing all kinds of quasi-relationships of funding sources to the university and gifts and grants coming into the university in such a way that the public side of the house, and I'm not saying that the private side of the house there's anything corrupt or unhappy about that, but the public side of the house is much less important now than it used to be in the
What are the political dynamics from your own experience that cause that shift? What's going on downtown? And how have we lost this old belief we used to have that it's in the best interest of the citizens to have an outstanding university?
I don't know, maybe Wisconsin is becoming more like the East Coast or the other parts of the country where...
You talked earlier about your own experience.
Yeah, you go to New England and public universities just aren't very important because there's so many private universities.
Yeah.
I think in what's happening in the Midwest is that, and what's happening in Wisconsin is that the Madison campus is really a victim of its own success. Because even though we might be tempted to say, well, we just can't get along without state dollars, and isn't this terrible what's happening to us, and this is really hurting us very badly, it's not true. There has been a rather, well, I wouldn't say it was completely smooth, but there's been a transition from funding sources that are gift and grant related, and the sharp decline of the state funding, an enormous increase in tuition, even though as a tuition it's still very small, but you know, a huge percentage increase in tuition, so that tuition is now greater than the state support is. So you wind up with all of the traditional pots of money from the university now going to replace state funding, and in fact our quality appears to be going up. The student body's credentials seem to improve as time goes by. The biggest place where this is difficult is general salaries for the liberal arts. We're still a victim of faculty raids when we have talented faculty going off to private universities or other state universities, because we haven't figured out overall how to guarantee the university's success as state support for salaries fades. And so you have some schools and colleges on the Madison campus with almost unlimited resources to provide additional compensation to faculty through such things as a CASB, the Business Schools Foundation, can pay their salaries to offer the courses on the weekend or at nights or for executive programs, and we run those all separately, and we don't own Granger Hall, or we do own Granger Hall, we don't own the Fluno, whatever that one is over on University Avenue.
Fluno Center,
we don't own that. You know, that's a privately run operation to benefit the School of Business. So you wind up with sort of like the family practice plan in the med school, where you can earn 150% of your state salary or whatever the exact percentage is, income coming in from the hospitals and clinics. In any one semester, the engineering department will have lots of faculty and staff on supplemental funds coming in from distance education courses. In other words, we are as a campus already well down the road toward additional compensation for faculty and staff outside the state budget. The problem with that is places like Letters and Science and Education are less likely to have those kinds of programs available. There are some departments in LNS, I'm sure, that where faculty can be compensated in various other ways. But in general, there are parts of the campus where that hasn't happened. And that's where, right now, the greatest tension between declining state resources and the university exists.
These departments,
liberal arts, humanities,
not having corporate resources or graduates of their own program that necessarily would be able to make contributions to their type of activity. Because people who graduate from some of the humanities, although this is a gross generalization, don't necessarily make the income that would encourage them to give back.
Well, a part of the problem is that donors don't necessarily give us money where the need is the greatest.
Yeah.
Many, even though where the need is the greatest is often a box on a form that they have the opportunity to check, they may want to invest in scholarships, or they may want to invest in supporting a particular program like science education or art class or something like that. I've never met a donor yet, other than people who give us money for chaired professorships, who really just want to pay the salary of somebody.
Yeah.
It seems like most everybody would say, hey, that's the job of the state. They haven't quite gotten around yet to saying, all right, I should pay a basic salary. They might, however, be willing to pay somebody to do research on the cure for something or other and give that person a grant, in which case you freed up the state money to use on somebody else.
How about the instance which has occurred over the last few years where somebody gives you a large sum of money to initiate studies in a certain area and they want to participate in the academic judgments that are made as to what should be taught and how it should be taught and so forth, the research. Did that ever crop up when you were here?
It doesn't crop up in the School of Education,
yeah,
to my knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think. I mean, famously, there have been a number of universities who say, no, I won't take Mr. Jones's money because he wants to,
yeah,
teach that the world is flat.
Or he gave us this money and now he wants us to do this and we don't want to do this, so we're giving the money back.
Yes. I think that actually the discussions, very mature discussions, take place between the foundation, the donors, and deans about what the money is going to be used for, and it's usually possible to come up with some sort of arrangement that pleases both the college and the donor.
Yeah.
And the real problem is, however, that we might wind up with too many resources. If everybody thinks reading is a problem, and everybody keeps giving us money for the reading program to teach teachers how to teach kids how to read better, all of a sudden we've got too much money.
Well, nobody reads anymore, so we don't need to bother with it.
That's absolutely true. So you wind up sometimes with your gift money misaligned with what the real needs of the college,
right,
are.
Yeah.
And that becomes a problem.
This is the big challenge, isn't it? To accept or encourage people to respond to your needs rather than to their own personal hobby horses, whatever.
Yes.
It might be.
And usually donors want to engage in those discussions and are amenable to making,
mm-hmm,
some modifications perhaps, but people do come in with very firm ideas sometimes about what they want the money to go for, and most of the time that's just fine, and once in a while it gets to be a strain because your resources aren't being allocated fairly among different parts of your department. But the whole question of how the university funds itself in times of declining state support and which arrangements are good and which ones are bad, you suddenly wind up with many colleges with foundations. Sometimes you discover that those foundations are actually, colleges are coming to rely on them, and perhaps when you have a downturn in the economy,
yeah,
and you're not generating the income that you were before, perhaps you have overextended yourself. And as I watch the stock market now, I am a little bit worried that parts of the institution may be It may be that those things which expanded and came to rely on certain revenue streams coming in from foundations that are now going to have a 3% rate of return instead of a 6 or something, that can make it enormous difficult.
Right.
That can make it very difficult, and I don't know for sure whether or not that's the case. I think generally on this campus, people who invest money at the foundation or who watch revenue streams are extremely cautious and conservative, appropriately so, when it comes to making these kinds of decisions. But certainly, if you've come to rely on $100,000 a year coming in for a dean's discretionary fund, and the dean has come to rely on it as a place to give somebody $10,000 when they get an outside offer or something like that, and then all of a sudden you only have $50,000, that's a problem. And that is happening now with the declining revenue streams.
Do you see this dwindling of the actual public support through the legislature reaching a point where it is, as you intimated earlier, going to be gone and will not ever come back again? Are we going to go that far?
I don't know. It certainly has reached the point now where Chancellor Wiley has said, and I think other people have said, well, gosh, we have a Board of Regents that's confirmed by the State Senate and appointed by the governor, and gosh, they're the fifth in line on our revenue stream now. We should really have the president of the foundation board on the regents, and we should have the director of athletics on the regents, you know, whatever it is.
That's Catherine Lyle's argument, isn't it?
Certainly, yes. She just says this is out of whack, because the state is unyielding in its bureaucratic requirements, and as you build buildings on this campus, you are struck again and again and again by the control exercised by bureaucrats in the state, in the state DOA or elsewhere, getting in the way of our ability to construct buildings. And
Is this because it's a state property?
Well,
so the state owns it.
Well, there's all kinds of things. I mean, right now, the biggest building projects on this campus are not being built by the state. They're being built on a turnkey basis, sort of, more or less.
Yeah, but they are state property once
they come back. And I think it's appropriate that the state owns the university. But that doesn't mean that you have to pay a premium of 20% when you're constructing buildings just because...
Oh, yeah.
Because you're paying 4% of your project goes to the state to supervise the construction, whatever that means.
Right.
And then you've got ridiculous assumptions with regard to the construction costs.
Well, you're right in the middle of that, you personally, aren't you?
Well, with the building project, yes.
Want to say something about that?
Well, it's the $32 million renovation of the education building on Bascom Hill. It's entirely gift funded, we were unable to secure from the State Building Commission the opportunity to have a single prime contractor, a general contractor, on the project. So now we have to deal directly with four or five contractors. There's an engineering firm, there's, furniture is different, this is different, that's different. So you're actually, as you're building the building now, plumbing will be different. In other words, there's no single general contractor who's responsible for making sure that the disputes between the contractors are resolved, and therefore it's going to fall to some of our staff and the campus to spend a much greater time, much higher percentage of time. The construction costs will increase substantially because we don't have a prime contractor. People will say, that's not my mistake, no, it's his mistake. So you wind up bargaining it, and whenever you bargain something like that, you have increased your cost because you'll have to have to put a little something for everybody into the pot in order to get it resolved.
It decreases the quality of the finished product.
It extends the life of the project, which is flat out a lot of cost.
Yeah.
And so it's, we have a very unusual, most states allow university systems to bond for their own projects. We have to bond through the state of Wisconsin, and universities which have their own bonding opportunities because they have tuition revenue sources that they can dedicate to paying back the bonds get a lower rate than states.
Yeah.
So now we're borrowing at a higher percentage just to help. What we're really doing is helping to keep the states AA or AAA bond rating in force.
Because and you're subsidizing their operations.
We've gone in the reverse. The state is not. Yeah. The state doesn't have any money at all in our building project, and we're paying them what will probably be a 10-15% premium.
Yeah. Which you, if you hired a private contractor.
Yes, if we had
a much cheaper.
Yes, it would be. So, that's the interesting mix when you're talking about how the Chancellor's Office allocates one-time money, or where does it, how does it try to get by when the state decline of spending is differential across the campus. So, if you're really looking at the impact of declining state support, most scholars looking at this area will say, all right, well, let's look at this, the consequences of this in terms of increases in tuition or the other problems that states face or whatever. They're developing mathematical models to try to explain why it is that higher education lost state support. And that's an interesting question. Probably because great universities like the Madison campus have developed the capacity to get by without the state support so easily that it became inevitable that they would continue to go to higher education. So there are two consequences to this. One is that places like Platteville or other institutions within the UW system have the greatest consequence of declining state support because they relied on the money the most and they don't have these revenue streams, and this is really killing programs and having a negative impact. And the second thing is that on a campus like the Madison campus, where everybody says, oh well, you're getting by because you've got all these other sources, in fact the real interesting question is that the impact on the Madison campus of declining state support is felt more by the liberal arts programs, the humanities, the arts, and felt much less by schools and colleges that have alternative ways of compensating faculty and can otherwise make up the difference, or the regents have given them the right to charge their own tuition, or they run executive programs like the executive MBA program where corporations will pay very high tuition, and so that generates money for the School of Business. And, you know, for all intents and purposes, state support has become much less important there. And no one has looked at the consequences within. Are we turning places like the Madison campus, are we going to wake up 10 years more from now and say, oh my God, this is the Wisconsin Institute of Technology. This is WIT. Just like MIT, this is not a great public university anymore, where the great breadth of programs was available to students to experiment and to learn from and to learn life skills. You're inevitably going to see the withering of some of the liberal arts and art and humanities programs, just even though the best of intentions may exist on the campus. It is the consequences of declining state support. I think that question needs to be talked about more on this campus and elsewhere. It is something I think that deans now currently are talking about on this campus.
Is it kind of howling against the wind? Is this a Darwinian reality that we're up against?
Well, to a certain extent it's howling against the wind, and to a certain extent it isn't, because campuses have the opportunity, for example, the lone example that I gave you when Letters in Science and CALS overestimated the amount of faculty they would have on grants and needed to be bailed out by getting more state money, then the campus loaned them the money. I think the campuses like Wisconsin now need to think about a different way, perhaps, of constructing the way they quote loan money, because this is an important way that campuses can encourage schools and colleges to establish successful programs, is that they're going to have to pick them up later on if it doesn't work out. If you don't have a stake in it yourself, you're probably not going to do as well with it. I think that the foundation and the campus ought to be, for example, paying all the costs of fundraising for departments that really need extra sources of revenue, because inevitably you're making an investment. A development officer doesn't even make their own salary until the third year, is a way of looking at it. And so you really have to, and then all of a sudden, if you have a very mature fundraising program, you're beginning to get estate gifts and other big payouts are coming back to you for the investment that you made some years earlier. And I think that the campus has not looked at all at, or should be looking at, a way of encouraging the foundation and schools and colleges like Education or Letters and Science to have more fundraisers, to do more entrepreneurial activities. The campus has now said, well, you can't start any more of these foundations that other schools and colleges have. Well, that's sort of backwards, it seems to me. It is, the real question is, how can existing foundation structures in business or elsewhere be either mimicked by other schools and colleges, or if they can't be mimicked, then is there some way that we can more routinely take a percentage of the increasing revenues of the places that are successful to fund the rest of the campus? It's sort of a, Wharf always gave lots of summer fellowships to faculty members in the art department. The art department got more Wharf grants in the summer per capita than any other part of the campus. Well, people were saying, and I think very nicely and correctly, hell, we should be supporting the art department. You know, they're the one, they don't have any source of money that they can use. Our scientists have grants and summer opportunities that are abounding. I think the idea that there's a have-not portion of the campus is something that's very hard to talk about.
Is the have-not because it's want-not? The people that have are part of the pipeline to the broader society, that they are providing trained individuals that are needed by business, industry, what have you, whereas artists are not in high demand in that regard.
Well, I think if we can't rely on our university administrators to recognize the importance of the liberal arts and the humanities, something is definite. We have a bigger problem than just money.
Right.
And I think, you know, I think task forces and, you know, Johnson Foundation seminars and all of these things ought to be considering this question, because all you have to do is drive across the campus or fly across the campus and look down at the parts of the campus that are getting all the new buildings and the big research centers and everything. Hell, I mean, we're struggling to raise money for a new art building. I mean, you know, business raises $85 million in a weekend by having its alumni call around and say, let's just give Dean Knetter a little help here. We'll just give him a new nest egg.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not seeing, 15 wealthy alumni giving $5 million each to build a new art building. I mean, we could stop right now and build the building if 15 people gave $5 million. I'm not saying John Wiley doesn't want to do this, and then Sandy Wilcox doesn't want to do this, but somehow or other, things are never quite right to get these things going. I think we have fancy plans and things in an arts corridor and all of that, but it's unfunded.
But getting back to, I think this is part of your continuing argument, is that any great university has to have these kinds of facilities and individuals if it's going to be a good university.
Yeah. And I think what I've also seen happen, I was looking back at some other issues over that we confronted in the chancellor's office over the time that I was there, and sometime soon we'll talk about athletics, and I'm thinking, of course, of sit-ins related to sweatshops clothing apparel and things like that. Well, you know, that was unpleasant, particularly for those of us whose offices they kept pounding on. But it was, I think, real issues were being presented and discussed on the campus about what is the relationship of the university's corporate connections to things like fair, fair wages for people.
Yeah.
I thought that was a very good discussion, even though it was sometimes raucous and certainly could have been more civil. But I'm not sensing that there is any discussion underway on the campus right now on the issues that I've been discussing, which is the sort of the slow decline through lack of investment in programs and buildings and structures that house the humanities and the liberal arts and the arts. And I think that needs to be talked about. I think actually it might be possible to awaken within the average undergraduate alum the desire to give $3 million if they had it for a new art building, just because the arts are important to all of the sciences on the campus and to the educational experiences of students here. The problem is, I think, that the question of who begins to advocate for people that don't have what they need becomes a real issue, because the liberal arts and education and other related programs that rely more on state support, I wouldn't say that they don't have advocates, because I think they have very able deans right now, but the problem is that they are so broad. You're talking about trying to find a foundation and a chancellor and a lot of other people who somehow or other are willing to say, I think I'm worried about the direction we're going in. We need a new Madison initiative or this or that. And part of the declining state support has been that legislators have caused the campus to hunker down and to not address the central educational issues that are on the campus, because to start talking about this and future of funding and so forth, why they might get mad at us,
right,
or whatever. So then we don't talk about it. And
We not only don't talk about it, but we don't go downtown and tell them why it's important to the state and the people of Wisconsin to have these kinds of things.
Well, it'd be nice if we had legislators like we used to have 25 years ago who would want to listen.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
So we've got a different environment, and it's not going to get any better because it looks like we're just going to have a bunch of ideologues for a long time.
Yeah.
So then the question is, how can we do this ourselves?
Yeah.
And I think that there are ways that we maybe can do this ourselves.
We have to go to the people as opposed to their quote-unquote elected representatives.
Well, we have to go to our donors and speak on behalf of democracy for units on the Madison campus.
Yeah.
That's really what I'm saying. And I have actually, when John and Tasha Markridge gave us $31 million because the state wouldn't keep up the education building anymore and it really needed to be retrofitted and new wings and everything added, or it was just going to be crummy forever, they were recognizing in some ways the new shape of the university ahead of their time. Mm-hmm. Because here's a donor saying, all right, I'm not, and of course they did give, you know, the Markridge Center
in
the Institute for Research. Yeah, it's very important. But they also recognized, as they always have as donors, that there are parts of the campus and parts of society that need attention that they as donors can contribute to.
Mm-hmm.
Their gift was really an oddball. It was the very first time that somebody had taken away the state's responsibility to fix up an old building.
Yeah.
And they did it all. And now we're having a hard time doing the project because of the building environment. But anyway, that's the discussion that we need to have, I think, is where are the funds? Crudely, an estimate to do the routine maintenance on the Madison campus has fallen behind, and it would now be 25 years to get it all done, and it would cost hundreds of millions of dollars, and we don't have any hundreds of millions of dollars, and we're just doing Band-Aids on our old buildings. It's shocking, some of them. And nobody's talking about that. I mean, people are saying those things. Perhaps nobody's talking about it because there's nobody listening.
Well, the other part of it is that our 40-year-old buildings now need to be raised rather than retrofitted.
Yes, that's a serious problem.
So you have to start over again.
And yes, we have some of those in education that were constructed in the 1960s, two of them. Fortunately, educational sciences, even though some of the windows look like they're going to fall out sometime soon, fortunately that building was constructed that would, on a modular basis, such that the walls and the the entire infrastructure can be modified. In other words, it's just an open space with temporary walls that could be moved around by us at any time. Mm-hmm. So you can get at the electrical system, can add new things. So that's, you know, that's a much better building. That was.
But the building we're in now has been here
for 100 years.
100 years and still standing.
Right.
Take a lot to knock it down, too.
Yeah. Anyway, I think we probably exhausted the finance topic.
Yeah, well, let's go on.
But I think it's a real one, and I'd be curious, listen to this in 10 years and see what happened then.
Well, let's hope we're both here in 10 years.
We will be,
yeah,
not right here in this office.
Yeah, right, but somebody may have to feed us while we're listening. But okay, let's end there.
Okay.
Thank you.